But first to our inaugural A Foreign Affair. It was from the end of February. As I said, it's been an end-of-the-month lively conversation that we've conducted about developments in the world, including Australia's place in it. Each guest nominated what they believed were the most significant issues, getting rid of the noise that often distorts what's important for our understanding. Some of the issues hit the headlines, some didn't. And because in February this year, it was really interesting to realise we were already talking about North Korea and missiles. So we thought it timely, to say the least, to reflect on how we saw the situation at the beginning of the year. And here we are in December. Our guests for this first A Foreign Affair were James Brown, an ex-soldier who's been commentating and writing for several years on military strategic matters. He's since taken a leave of absence for the year from the US Studies Centre at Sydney University, where he's Director of Research. Alex Oliver works at the Lowy Institute. She's deeply absorbed in Australian attitudes to matters external through her guidance of the respected Lowy Poll. And Alan DuPont is well known and admired as an analyst on strategic developments and on what is asked of Australia. He's also an ex-soldier whose regular articles in The Australian are required reading, in my view. He's founded his own consultancy, the Cognoscenti Group.
Thanks, Geraldine. How are you?
Hi.
Now, ironically, there's more news, I'd suggest to you, these days of foreign affairs in the bulletins and the headlines and the blogs, because everyone feels everything's so much less predictable. I invite you all to carve your way through all of this and isolate which, in your view, are the issues that matter and which just stir people up unnecessarily, maybe. Alan, you've nominated the North Korea missile test. Before I ask you to say why, let's remember how we found out about it.
Tonight, two U.S. officials tell CNN U.S. intelligence satellites have picked up signs of activity at a North Korean missile factory, a signal, they say, that Kim Jong-un's regime is preparing some kind of ballistic missile test in the coming days, a possible provocation against the new administration. South Korean officials told the Yonhap news agency the missiles being prepped could be intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, which could, at some point, be capable of hitting the American mainland with a nuclear-tipped warhead.
So, Alan, why does this matter? Some might say it's terribly arcane.
Well, it matters for two reasons, Geraldine. And the first thing is the nature of North Korea. And we've all seen North Koreans on TV. We've seen Kim Jong-un, the leader, he with the short back and sides and the sort of the big glasses, is a bit of a figure of fun in the Western press, but he's a deadly serious character. And the problem is he's got nuclear weapons. He didn't have them probably 10 years ago, but his father managed to get some nuclear weapons. And now they're actually going to put them on missiles that may be able to reach continental United States and certainly can reach Australia.
When you say may, what do you mean?
Yeah, when I say may is we know they can get so far at the moment, but because these tests are inconclusive, we don't have hard evidence that they can get to the continental United States yet. But pretty much all the experts think it'll happen in the next 3 or 4 years, regardless. So not just the West Coast, but probably as far as New York. So this is a big problem for the United States now.
Look, I sort of thought that everybody felt that this was being overblown, that there was a sense that even though he blundered on about it, that it wasn't real.
Yes, it's definitely real. And we've only come to realise that in the last few years because all these tests are what enable us to tell how quickly these missiles are developing. And we now know a lot about their range, which is obviously critical here. So once you know the range, you know that they can shrink a nuclear warhead and stick it on the missile, and they've got more and more of these warheads, we now know that this is a far bigger problem than we thought even a few years ago.
Yes, I noticed, you know, Alex, that the Obama administration listed it as the number one national security problem that they thought would confront the Trump team. I just wonder with you, you know, sort of with your knowledge of Australian attitudes, do you think we've engaged at all with this properly?
Not so much as the Americans. When we ask Australians what are the number one threats to us here in Australia, it's usually terrorism. But the nuclear threat is there. Australians regard it as a critical threat and a threat to our security interests, and so it's there. But I think these sort of incidents and this sort of increasing frequency of missile tests are going to raise the consciousness of Australians about this risk, and it is becoming a much more real. I think Australians have regarded it in the past as quite remote, not really something that we have to be concerned about here, but it is becoming more pressing.
Well, actually, you did. I sort of said we weren't going to unnecessarily terrify people, but I did read in your very good article on this, Alan, that you said, look, it's possible they won't, because they're basically trying to keep the Americans away from them. They want the Americans to stay out of it. And you say that they learned a lot of lessons from Saddam Hussein, that you couldn't keep the Americans away if you didn't have something to frighten them with. They might even say, well, we won't frighten America fully. We'll aim for the Pine Gap facility, which is almost where a lot of American material is translated. We'll aim for that, just to show we can. So that frightened me sufficiently.
Yeah, well, it is pretty frightening. I don't want to scare people too much. I'm not saying it's likely, but if you're looking at the scenarios, which is what people in the Defence Department should be doing, you think, well, what's the threat to Australia? And you'd have to say that now the North Koreans can fire a missile with a nuclear warhead and cover the whole of Australia. If they were going to fire one at us, why would they do that? And what would they target? And I thought one possibility would be just near Pine Gap, we have this joint facility of the US and Australia. Among its roles is to monitor missile tests such as the one that the North Koreans did last week. So that might, if you didn't want to actually sign a suicide note and attack the United States, maybe you could send a message to the US we're deadly serious by targeting something in Australia, such as that Pine Gap facility. Now, I think that's a scenario I'd look at seriously. And then I'd ask our people to say, well, what if that was the case, what could we do about it?
And what's the answer?
And the answer is we can do things about it. We can develop missile defence systems to shoot down these incoming missiles. We have the technology to do that. It already exists. But Australia hasn't really put a lot of effort into that because we thought it's a highly unlikely contingency, right? But I think it's much more likely now.
Oh. Does that frighten you, James Brown?
It does, and it should. I mean, we know that when then-President-elect Trump met with President Obama, what they talked about in the last half of that meeting was the possibility that North Korea would be able to do this during the first term of the Trump administration. And the Trump team is doing a review of North Korea policy at the moment, trying to work out new methods to deal with this. But four US administrations have tried to deal with this and come to naught.
It's the Chinese who can do something about it, isn't it? That's the whole thesis.
The Chinese...
the only ones who've really got leverage over them.
They have some levers they can pull. They've slowed down iron ore exports across the border at the moment. They could cut off fuel supplies. But they don't know this guy a lot better than we do. They've never met President Xi and Kim. So they are not quite able to control him as we would hope they would be able to.
Yeah, I think that's an important point James makes, that the Americans in particular go on about the Chinese heavying the North Koreans because they're the only ones who can do anything about it. But I've talked to a lot of Chinese diplomats about this, and I think this is a genuine response. They feel that they can't do a lot for a couple of reasons. One, they don't have the sort of the influence on North Korea that a lot of people think they do. That's the first. And secondly, what they're worried about is they really put pressure on the North Koreans through sanctions, stop buying their coal, for example. The worst case scenario for them is the North Korean regime collapses. All those North Koreans go pouring across the border into China, right? And there are these things, loose nukes, as we call them, these nuclear weapons, unsecured, somewhere in North Korea. Now, we've seen this story before. So, you know, you'll be careful what you wish for. So the Chinese make a valid point here, but I think the Americans nevertheless do need to get them to do as much more than they've done.
Okay, well, look, just to calm everybody down.
That bright
night. That's a good kickoff. Now, Alex, an entirely different set of personalities and events took your eye.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And can I start by saying that I'm so pleased that I've been able to be here today, and thank you for inviting me so soon after your inauguration. I'm delighted to be able to congratulate you on what was a stunning election victory. And as you say, the invitation is an indication of the strength and importance of the special relationship that exists between our two countries, a relationship based on the bonds of history, of family, kinship, and common interests. And in a further sign of the importance of that relationship, I have today been able to convey Her Majesty the Queen's hope that President Trump and the First Lady would pay a state visit to the United Kingdom later this year, and I'm delighted that the President has accepted that invitation.
So why did that pique your interest, the relationship between Theresa May and Donald Trump?
It was a really interesting invitation because it came very early on in the Trump administration, and I think that was somewhat something of a record that only two American presidents had been invited on official state visits to the United Kingdom in the history of relations. And the invitation to President Trump came within 7 or 8 days. So it shocked, obviously, the British population, who then put together a petition of 1.5 million Britons who were opposed to this visit.
Because they didn't want the Queen exposed to such a humiliating.
Well, now there's a little bit of a debate about where the invitation came from, because I believe that the Prime Minister's office has blamed the Queen for issuing the invitation, and the Queen's office has blamed the Prime Minister issuing the invitation, as reported by CNN. So you can form your own views on that. But however it happened, the invitation was issued, and the Britons are trying to deal with it. When in the UK a petition gathers over 100,000 signatures, it actually has to be debated in Parliament. And so it was debated in Parliament, but there was no issue, there was no vote, there was no final vote on that, because it's the Prime Minister who has the ultimate say on that, and not even the Queen has a say. But what interested me was the implications for the Western world, really, about how the UK has indicated it's going to engage with the Trump administration, which is obviously a little bit controversial given that 1.5 million people protested against it. And it's important for a number of reasons for Australia, because it indicates Britain's anxiety about its trading relationships post-Brexit. And that has implications for Australia's own anxiety about international trade post the seeming collapse of the TPP, and we don't yet know what's going to be salvaged out of that, if anything. And if that anxiety about trade, which Britain has in a sort of a Brexit context, is so severe that they feel the compulsion to engage with the Trump administration so closely and in such a formal and official way through an invitation to attend Buckingham Palace, that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the Anglosphere and for the like-minded nations. Now, we're in a relationship with the United Kingdom, the United States, New Zealand, and Canada in our Five Eyes relationship and intelligence cooperation, which is very important to all of us. But just as important is the trading relationships and how intertwined we are in the world. And for Australia in a post-TPP environment, the United States is incredibly important to us. It's our number one source of foreign direct investment, and I think a lot of Australians actually don't appreciate the importance of the United States and the trading relationship, because all of the focus is on China and how important China is as our number one trading partner.
You're picking up the whole idea of anxiety, which you're right, of course, that it does indicate acute anxiety in a sense. And I suppose in its own way, in a world with shifting sands, when something like Britain indicates that level of anxiety, that says something, doesn't it? It possibly does move the dial a little bit in terms of perceptions for people looking on, James. I mean, maybe, you know, if you look, I was stunned that she was so hasty and really surprised. And we had Craig Oliver, who used to be David Cameron's communications director, on the show. And we talked to him afterwards. And I said, why did she feel the need to do it so fast? He said, well, she's hemmed in. He said, Brexit is now determining our foreign policy.
Well, she'd been led there by the sort of bromance between Trump and Farage and all of the sort of similarity between the vote in America and the vote in the UK. I think she was right to do it.
Do you?
Early, I do. I think it reinforced Britain as the special partner. I think, yes, there's some anxiety about it, but I thought it was smart to speak to the Republicans directly at their Congress. It sort of gave
even though it completely changed, like I think George W. didn't get there for 15 months or something or other.
Yeah, look, I mean, there is something about timing that is very important in these visits, and it's a live debate in Australia right now. You know, when should our leaders go to the US and do their big visits? What should be the character of them? Do we go too early? Do we go too late? It's a fascinating process.
Yeah. What do you think, Alan?
Yeah, I think, look, leads to sort of discussion, I suppose, about the importance of sort of personal visits, you know. But
I'm going to get to that
next. If you're arguing you've got a special relationship with the United States, prove it, right? Demonstrate it. And you demonstrate it by saying, I got in first to see the man, the new man, which is what Theresa May did. And but who beat her to the punch? Abe, Japanese Prime Minister.
He did indeed.
Right? So there is a kind of pecking order of who's going to get in first to see the new president, right?
And then, of course, there's a mooted visit of our own Prime Minister in the next couple of months.
That's right.
But do you think the Australian people, say, I might ask Alex this before we move on, would have liked to see, given what you know about the polling, would have liked to see Prime Minister Turnbull rush off there?
Well, that's a very interesting question in a post-telephone call context, isn't it? I think that's probably infected Australians' views of how we want to engage directly with President Trump. I don't know what you think about James.
That's a very thorny question.
But look, our own polling indicates that President Trump was not Australia's popular choice for the new president of the United States, and we now have to live with what's happened. 77% of Australians wanted Hillary Clinton to be president of the United States. Now that he's there and he's been inaugurated and he's busy issuing many orders, the world, looks like a different place, and it has been a very long month.
Now, perfect segue, because in fact the second last discussion that I'd like to have today is about the importance of visits. And in a sense, James Brown, we've just had this big visit by Netanyahu, the first Israeli Prime Minister to visit Australia. And of course, Joko Widodo from Indonesia, arguably a far more significant visit, arriving as we speak. Let's listen to the way the Prime Minister addressed the President of the Prime Minister of Israel.
We have so much in common. Shared values, democracy, freedom, the rule of law. Two great democracies, one very small in area, one vast, but each of us big-hearted, generous, committed to freedom. Prime Minister, you are so welcome here in Australia.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you.
So, James, on reflection, what intrigues me is how important these visits are, both from us looking on, Australians looking on, and them, people looking in at us in terms of how we, do they matter at all?
They matter very much. I mean, firstly, because there is a quality to face-to-face personal interaction in terms of conveying a message or sending a signal. You know, we know in our own lives, an email isn't the same as meeting somebody face-to-face. And to get an Israeli Prime Minister with all their woes and worries to come to the Southern Hemisphere is quite a rare thing. There's also an important sort of cadence to these visits. They drive a lot of official energy in departments and offices around the world. So they make deals happen, because as soon as you have a visit on the horizon, you've got to have something to do, something to talk about. So departments start furiously coming up with ideas and looking for things to sign and things to stand in front of. So they sort of drive the tempo of the relationship in a way.
And they also invite protests. I mean, because I tend to get through my emails all the people who are both happy and outraged at the Prime Minister of Israel's visit. So I feel I got to see quite a wide range of views. And then we did see some protest, although the 500 security people didn't exactly let them very close. But, I don't think it's as straightforward as it seems.
No, it does dominate the agenda. So what were we talking about this week? We were talking about the one state or the two state solution. We might have been talking about that anyway because of his visit to the US. The interesting thing for me in Netanyahu's visit was the fact that he spent so much time in Singapore on the way here. That is a relationship that is growing.
They're
in quite interesting relative strategic positions. They do a lot of cooperation on technology development, for example, and that's not immediate obvious until you see a visit like that happening.
Mm. Yeah, and I think you've got Netanyahu is one of those leaders you'd love to hate. You know, even pro-Israeli people have reservations about him. But the thing is, there's the public sort of perception of what a leader is, but then beneath that, the real business of states goes on regardless of who the leader is. And this is what a lot of people don't understand. So to pick up the point about Israel and Singapore, who would have believed there was any substance to that relationship? It's a very substantial relationship. Who would believe that the Indonesians actually have a lot of contact with the Israelis as a Muslim state, and remembering, you know, Israel is persona non grata among most of the Muslim countries in the world, but actually underneath the surface, there's a lot of dealing, wheeling and dealing going on there. So you do have to separate the, you know, it's a bit like watching a soapy. You see the stuff, the visuals of leaders meeting and demonstrations and all that. That's going on the surface. A lot of that's superficial. But when you get down to the real core of the relationship, you will often be surprised at how substantive it is. And I think Australia and Israel are going down that route too.
Well, it was interesting. Iris Mackler, who used to work for the ABC, wrote a piece on the weekend saying that she thought that actually Netanyahu lost 10 years of his life because in Israel he's the subject of constant sort of picking, and because he's, you know, he's got a lot of issues politically. Here he was, you know, he was feted. There were really five billionaires at the function earlier in the Wednesday, the big thing at Bondi Synagogue. So I suppose it can be an incredible relief, I suppose, James, when people come to a sunny place like Australia and get welcomed.
Look, it can be. It can also be very dangerous for domestic politics. So when George Bush came here and popped up on the back of a sort of nice cruiser sort of going down Sydney Harbour, the chatter back in Washington was saying, what is this guy doing taking a holiday on the beach down in Australia? So when Obama came to Australia a couple of years ago, the message was very clear. There will be no harbourside cruises. There will be no beach trips. It's sort of straight to the speech, straight to work.
Keep
and
the
then
suit
home.
Coat on.
That's right.
Look, I just want to offer my own highlight of the past month, if I may, rather. It was an incredibly challenging take on some deep underlying attitudes to the international order, supposedly held by one of the key men around Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, who the leading conservative commentator, David Brooks, quoted remarks by Mr. Bannon to a Vatican conference in 2014 when he apparently outlined why he believed the party of Davos, with its globalisation, I'm quoting here, relativism, pluralism and diversity, had sapped away the moral foundations of a Judeo-Christian way of life, and that he actually said Putin's Russia could be looked at to look at the traditionalism they employed. Very, very interesting comments indeed. Now, I mean, Alex Oliver, this is pretty deep stuff that is apparently sort of surprising even the Republicans. Can you see that echoing down? Do you think many people who are interested in foreign affairs have taken note of this? Do you think it'll change anything?
I think a lot of things have changed, and it goes back to the sort of larger question of whether individuals change history or whether history throws up individuals. And I think what we're seeing with the rise of populist politics, whether it's President Trump or whether it's Nigel Farage or whether it's Pauline Hanson in Australia, these are people who have been thrown up by broader social movements. And so the sort of thing that Steve Bannon from Breitbart News is picking up on are trends that are evident in across the Western world. And I think these are things that we need to take notice of.
Well, I suppose it's that question of how, whether you play into fears about them or you help people sort of come to realise that they are there, but they're in the process. People are trying to fix them. And it's a process of this, James. So that's what I think is so fascinating. How do you stop the panic, really? It's a sort of an apocalyptic clash of civilizations.
Well, we saw that at the Munich Security Conference a week ago, where the US Vice President Pence went to reassure people, don't worry, you know, America is still your friend, we're still with you, as long as you give us a little bit more. And to the European NATO allies who've been saying, we believe in a values-based foreign policy, we believe in a liberal international order, that was a big pitch, and I don't think they bought it. We are at a point in time where the sort of premise of international relations is having to be argued from first principles. And there are people who don't agree with it. Now, it's not all doom and gloom, but it will change.
It has to be re-argued. What do you think, Alan?
Look, people put countries in boxes just as we put other people in boxes, you know, and it doesn't capture the complexity of a relationship. So the Russians, for example, many Russians would say, we have more in common with the West than you guys realise, because we've got the same, religious sort of foundations, cultural foundations, etc. And it's true. But because they're characterised as the bad guys, you know, having the Cold War period, people think of them as the enemy and completely different to us. But it's not the case. And often you find that people, the countries you've had a kind of tactical relationship with and appear to be friends, then it turns around because there's not a, not the glue holding it together. This is the values argument. You know, when you say, yeah, what are the things we have in common with a country X, like the United States? It's interests and values. When we talk about Indonesia, for example, we only talk about interests, not values.
Sure, China.
So, or China. China, exactly. Yeah. In fact, the difference is we have different values. But with a country like Russia, we tend to think there's no value sort of similarities there, but there are. There are. Mm. And it's just the way you actually
Anna
perceive these countries.
Anna Politkovskaya wouldn't agree. I mean, you know, I mean, that's the trouble.
Sure.
Some of the things that the Putin administration seems to value is certainly not shared by people around the world. But look, we'll leave that hanging. And I want to thank you all very much, James Brown, Alan DuPont and Alex Oliver, for taking part in our inaugural Foreign Affair. So thanks again for you all for joining us.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And my thanks to James Brown, who has taken a year of absence from his position as Adjunct Associate Professor and Research Director at the US Studies Centre. Alan DuPont is CEO of Political and Strategic Risk Consultancy Group, the Konyashenty Group. And Alex Oliver is Director of the Polling Program at the Lowy Institute.